Oh, that's right. We're right back here. 4:39 in the afternoon, and it's hour number two of Meet Me at the Diner. I tell you what, we have a very special guest today. We have Jill Bossy. She is a member of the American Party. We're going to find out what the American Party is in just a second. And she is running against Tim Scott. So how you doing today, Jill Bossy?
Doing well, Anne. Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
It is good to have you here. And let's see, are you headed over to Newberry this evening?
No, I am not.
You're not on the Newberry group.
No, I'm not on the Newberry group.
Okay, all right.
More than likely, that's our friends in the Republican Party that are having a party.
Oh, that are having a party. Okay. All right. Well, Jill Bossy, what can you tell us? You were recently served as the American Red Cross's Vice President and Chief Procurement Officer.
Correct.
That was quite a title there.
Well, it was a wonderful job. I mean, it was a great opportunity. I took the job leaving Bank of America in their supply chain, and I took the job in 2009 because it came available. It was a brand new role. It allowed me to stay in the Charlotte metropolitan area. I live in TKK, just over the border, and it was a great role to be able to bring all of my skills from working for a number of large for-profit companies and bring it to bear for a wonderful organization, the American Red Cross, and do something that had meaning and had value. And at the end of the day, when I went home, I felt like I was contributing to helping people, and so it was a great job.
Absolutely. I guess, though, that was probably right in the time, though, when Bank of America and some of our other big banks were pulling back a little bit.
Absolutely. It was it was just following what they call the Great Recession. And I was one of the members of the team while I was at Bank of America working on the transition, as they call it, with Merrill Lynch, bringing Merrill Lynch on board. And so I spent quite a lot of time up in New York working with teams up there to transition over the operations from a supply chain perspective of Merrill Lynch into the Bank of America model. And so I was able to see a lot of what was going on and kind of got a good sense that things were probably not going to be too positive for too long. So it was a good time to look at other opportunities.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. So what did you, working with the American Red Cross, I guess you spent a lot of time up in Washington?
I did. I got a lot of opportunity. The American Red Cross obviously has their national headquarters there in Washington, right across from the White House, actually, right there on 17th and E Street. It's a beautiful, historic building. Mm-hmm. I did go up there quite often because a number of my team was up there, as well as the executive leadership of the organization. And so I got a lot of opportunity to spend time in Washington, D.C., which is a beautiful city.
It
really is a
city.
Gem. And I don't think enough American citizens get the opportunity to go there and take advantage of all of the wonderful Smithsonian museums and all of the exhibits and all of the history that city bears for us. So I would really recommend it highly to anyone that, in Fort Mill just this week, we had the traveling Vietnam War Memorial. And
we had that here in Greenwood. Yeah.
Yeah, it just was there. And obviously being in Washington, D.C., I got to walk in the mornings. I walked along the mall
there. Mm-hmm.
And I got to see the actual Vietnam Memorial, and it is very stirring.
Yeah, there is no comparison, though, to looking at the memorial up there in Washington, D.C., and to see the traveling one. It's great if you've never been able to see it,
right.
But everybody should take that time to see that one. And, of course, they just opened the new Disabled Veterans Memorial up there in Washington, D.C., too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things that, in some ways, it's so subliminal, the idea, because you can't see the monument itself if you're just walking upon it. It's something that catches you by surprise. And
yes.
Then as you walk along those walls and you see the names of all of those heroes who died defending what we believe in, it just takes your breath away. And you really have to sit and contemplate it for a while to understand just the depth and the breadth of that kind of heroism that is so hard to understand, and they deserve so much of our gratitude for everything that they did.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the things that was very special for me when I was up there was seeing all the items that are left at the wall, whether it was a magazine or a badge or a flower or whatever it was, there was something very significant being left. And I think it was also truly terrific that the Smithsonian was, they took those items and they kept them so that they could be put on display.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many unique and meaningful things to see in D.C. And right, it's the Vietnam War Memorial is right down the mall from the World War II Memorial.
Yep.
And that, again, that's large and impressive, and it really does grab your attention. And certainly those heroes as well deserve our attention. But those are the things that that Americans, just everyday Americans, need to go and see and experience, because it's their city. It belongs to the public, right?
Oh, we kind of forget that every once in a while, don't we?
We do. We forget a lot that America belongs to us as the citizens, and that we have to not only take pride in what we have, but we have to take responsibility for it.
We should. We absolutely should. I'll tell you one more memorial story, and then we're going to leave this. The Korean Memorial there is very eerie, and when you see that one, you can really get the whole feel of what those men and women were going through over there.
Absolutely.
The gaunt look in the eyes and all of that. Okay, moving on. We could spend a whole hour talking about Washington, D.C., and that's not the purpose here today. Mm. But one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know that much about is the American Party of South Carolina. This is a relatively new party.
Absolutely. It's a brand new party. We just got certified by the state of South Carolina in January of this year. Jim Rex, who was the former state superintendent of schools, and Oscar Loveless, who ran for the Republican gubernatorial back in 2008, got together as a Democrat and a Republican and said, you know, the system is broken. There are problems that are mounting for our country, and the existing parties are not addressing those problems. They spend time fighting with one another. We've got to come up with something, another approach. And that's where the American Party, or the idea for the American Party, was born, in that idea that we need to focus on our economy. We need to focus on our global competitiveness. We need to focus on term limits and things that will move our country forward and not continue this hyper-partisanship, this bickering, this fighting that continues to go on in Washington, D.C., because it's destroying our country. So they were certified on January 23rd, and they really had a challenge that said, okay, by March 31st, basically, they had to see if they could find individuals who were willing to stand behind the party and go and run for office. And they were able to find four of us, myself included. I'm running for the U.S. Senate, as you said, against Tim Scott and Joyce Dickerson for the unexpired term, which is a two-year term.
Correct.
To fulfill that which Jim DeMint had left. So this same office will be on the ballot again in 2016, so that people aren't confused. Senators usually serve for a six-year term, and that is correct, but this one was to fulfill the unexpired term of Jim DeMint, who left to go and head up the Heritage Foundation.
Is there just the American Party in South Carolina, or is this a national party?
It is currently just in South Carolina. South Carolina was the first state to go through the petition process and to get it on certified within the state according to the laws of the state of South Carolina. Jim is talking to a number of other people in other states who are very interested, but each state in the union has a different process for new parties being, if you will, certified and capable of being on the ballot. For Michigan, you have to get 30,000 signatures in a 90-day period of time. For Kentucky, it's something different. For Georgia,
sure.
It's something different.
Absolutely.
Yet again. So that's...
It has to do with the population and the size of the state.
Well, and the state's laws as it relates to new parties being validated, if you will, for
sure.
The ballot.
Sure. All right. So the issues, as you said, term limits, ethical behavior, focus on solving the nation's economic and competitiveness issues without the distraction of single issues and divisive politics.
Right.
That sounds wonderful.
Sure it does.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds wonderful, but how do you get there?
Well, you know, I think it sounds wonderful and it sounds reasonable and logical to most voters. And that's the important part, right, is that this is something that all of the voters are asking for. I was talking with the gentleman outside before coming in here, and we were talking about just the issues like this. The Democratic and the Republican parties have, in essence, left the people behind. They have gone on to be very focused on their issues, but not on the people that they serve. And so as we look at this as a nation, as a state, as a city even, we have to start to question, do those people that are currently serving in public office really have my individual best interest at heart, or are they more concerned about the people who give them money, the people who ensure that they get elected year over year, the people who are donating to their campaigns? Those are the kinds of questions we have to ask ourselves. That's why this looks so good to most people, because it is reasonable to expect that from our public servants.
But do you have donors?
I have very few donors.
Because you're a very new party.
A very new party, right.
You would have donors if this party takes hold, for lack of a better way to say it.
Well, I agree that a political process needs money to use the airwaves, if you will, television, radio, the media of all kinds, to get the word out, to get name recognition going. But I don't think it needs the extremes that we're dealing with and what we're seeing today. I was talking to somebody earlier. They're going to spend over $100 million, or they have spent over $100 million in North Carolina for the Hagan-Tillis race.
Right.
They're projected to spend over $100 million for the McConnell-Lundgren-Grimes race in Kentucky. Those numbers are obscene when we think about what it means. What it's representing is our public servants who are really our employees. So one of the proposals that I'm going to make if I am given the gift of becoming the U.S. Senator for the state of South Carolina would be that we restrict how much an individual candidate could raise and how much that individual candidate could spend. My current proposal is that we do it based upon registered voters, and it's $1 per registered voter. So in the state of South Carolina, that would limit the gubernatorial and the U.S. senators to about $2.5 million. Not an unreasonable sum, but at the same time, it's not an obscene sum either. It would limit the presidency to about $150 million, because there's about 150 million registered voters in the United States today. It's a way of giving a simple solution across the U.S. for every state, every city, every county, every role that is running, by simply saying don't raise any more and don't spend any more than this. And it doesn't restrict who can give the money. It
right.
doesn't change those election laws, if you will. It simply limits the ceiling on both the raising of those monies and the spending of those monies.
Well, I have often thought, what would be if the dollars were limited? You know, millions of dollars would still give you a very big advantage. But if the dollars were limited, if you could only spend $50,000 on an election, would we see more of our legislators going door to door? Would they be out there talking to the people more?
Well, I think that certainly they would be talking to the people more. I think what the American citizens have forgotten is the power of their vote. I've talked to so many people, and they say, well, my vote doesn't matter, right? Or it doesn't matter. And if you look at the turnout that Americans have at the polls, right, we're anywhere from just above 50% to maybe 60% in a presidential election year. Most other countries, including countries like Afghanistan, who have just gotten the right, are well above 75%.
And they're proud to have their finger green or whatever, purple.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And that is something that we've lost here. And if the American voter would simply turn out to the polls in the numbers that they should be,
yes,
they would start to learn that they do have. Their one vote is worth more than the hundreds of millions of dollars being pumped into the political system by wealthy donors today.
But that also, on the flip side, would mean that they should become schooled in the issues and what is happening, and we really need to put civics back in our schools so that our students growing up have some idea what all this political process is about.
Absolutely. And I have talked to so many young people, and one of the reasons why I got into this race in the first place was I have four grandchildren, And I looked at the state of our country and I said, what am I leaving to my posterity? What am I leaving to my children, to my grandchildren? And in the future, what will they look back and say about me in terms of what I did? And that was one of the key factors that made me decide to run, that at least I could look my grandchildren in the eye and say, I tried. Mm-hmm. I tried to do something to bring common sense and civility and responsibility back to the political process by running as someone who believes in this country very much and believes that we really do have the best in front of us if we are willing as Americans to roll up our sleeves and go to work the way that our parents and grandparents
did. I think that's the biggest problem, because I think Americans don't have that will to roll up their sleeves and go to work.
Right.
I think we've become very passive. I think the handouts, having about 49% of our residents on food stamps and this type of thing, has taken a lot of that away from us.
Well, I think that it's taken a lot. There's a lot of things that have contributed to the fact that Americans are not getting out to vote the way that they used to. But one of the things that's really interesting as you really start to look at the data is this issue of, in the past, Americans made sure that the future was better, right? Mm-hmm. So our parents or our grandparents worked hard to make sure that their children's future was better. We've started to back away from that.
And have we backed away from that, though, because of the economy and because of what we're dealing with, that we're not bouncing back the way, you know, a recession, a pullback? That's not a bad thing.
You know, my parents lived through, my father was born in 1915 and my mother was born in 1922. They lived through the Great Depression.
Right. But the economy came back.
Right, eventually.
And the wheels were put forth to make things happen.
Right, and that was the government that played a huge role in doing that. Anybody that's just watched the recent PBS series on the Roosevelts could see a lot of good history and kind of understand what the government had to do in order to help bring America out of that depression. But there's a lot of things that we can do here today that don't require that. The Great Recession was definitely traumatic for our economy, but it did not bring us to our knees. And there are things that we can do to re-stimulate our economy, to bring good jobs back. The most important thing is we have to restore the middle class. The middle class is the linchpin in making America work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to...
How are we going to do that?
Well, one of the things that we need to do is we need to bring good jobs back here to the U.S.
How are we going to do that?
Well, there's an interesting thing called reshoring. So I'm a supply chain management geek, right?
Okay.
I'm a supply chain management executive.
Okay.
One of the big things that happened in the past was they did a lot of things about outsourcing and offshoring. So the American manufacturers moved jobs to Southeast Asia, to lower cost countries, because they were looking at the cost issues. But what they're starting to find out with the issues of risk, with the issues of global, the different issues in different countries with how those political issues are handled in different countries, the issues of hurricanes or natural disasters, et cetera, companies are starting to realize that they cannot have a single location, whether it be in Japan or Southeast Asia or over in Europe, et cetera. They're starting to look at what their total cost of ownership is. And if we work very closely with those companies and we start to devise strategies and plans for them to bring jobs back here to America, and we align along much more of a geographic, if you will, hemispheric approach, so that we're looking at North and South America, where you can move things north and south by, not by boat or by air, but rather by wheels, by trucks, by train, etc. So those are the things that we can do. And there's actually a group out of Chicago called the Reshoring Initiative, and they're working very closely with a number of companies. And the numbers are coming back very positive. It will make more economic sense for companies to come back here. And quite honestly, companies want to work here. Americans are the most innovative, and we can create those innovative products and services, and that will bring good jobs back here. And as we begin to grow out of that, we'll be able to create other jobs in other areas, and perhaps even be able to solve our immigration problem by ensuring that there are jobs in South America that will keep the people there. They come here because they need jobs. Well, let's work on on a more global scale and start to look at how do we do that. Ford Motor Company has done it very successfully. Ford Motor Company is the only company that did not take a government handout. But they are very successful in terms of what they do in terms of innovation in the U.S. and in terms of using lower cost labor just over the border. So we can look at who does this and who's got best practices, and we can start to replicate that on a broader scale and bring good jobs back here.
There you go. And with that, I've got to interrupt you.
Okay.
You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. Let's hear the news and a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Jill Bossie. She is with the American Party. She is running for Tim Scott's office. Hey, we'll be back afterwards. You got a question for Jill? You like what you hear? Give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
Gold. Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, 4:39 in the afternoon, and it's hour number two of Meet Me at the Diner. I tell you what, we have a very special guest today. We have Jill Bossie. She is a member of the American Party. We're going to find out what the American Party is in just a second, and she is running against Tim Scott. So how you doing today, Jill Bossie?
Doing well, Ann. Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
It is good to have you here. And let's see, are you headed over to Newberry this evening?
No, I am not.
You're not on the Newberry group.
No, I'm not on the Newberry group.
Okay, all right.
More than likely, that's our friends in the Republican Party that are having a party.
Oh, that are having a party. Okay. All right. Well, Jill Bossie, what can you tell us? You were the recently served as the American Red Cross's Vice President and Chief Procurement Officer.
Correct.
That was quite a title there.
Well, it was a wonderful job. I mean, it was a great opportunity. I took the job leaving Bank of America in their supply chain, and I took the job in 2009 because it came available. It was a brand new role. It allowed me to stay in the Charlotte metropolitan area. I live in TKK, just over the border, and it was a great role to be able to bring all of my skills from working for a number of large for-profit companies and bring it to bear for a wonderful organization, the American Red Cross, and do something that had meaning and had value. And at the end of the day, when I went home, I felt like I was contributing to helping people, and so it was a great job.
Absolutely. I guess, though, that was probably right in the time, though, when Bank of America and some of our other big banks were pulling back a little bit.
Absolutely. It was it was just following what they call the Great Recession. And I was one of the members of the team while I was at Bank of America working on the transition, as they call it, with Merrill Lynch, bringing Merrill Lynch on board. And so I spent quite a lot of time up in New York working with teams up there to transition over the operations from a supply chain perspective of Merrill Lynch into the Bank of America model. And so I was able to see a lot of what was going on and kind of got a good sense that things were probably not going to be too positive for too long. So it was a good time to look at other opportunities.
Absolutely. Well, that's great. So what did you, working with the American Red Cross, I guess you spent a lot of time up in Washington?
I did. I got a lot of opportunity. The American Red Cross obviously has their national headquarters there in Washington, right across from the White House, actually, right there on 17th and E Street. It's a beautiful, historic building.
Mm-hmm.
I did go up there quite often because a number of my team was up there, as well as the executive leadership of the organization. And so I got a lot of opportunity to spend time in Washington, D.C., which is a beautiful city.
It
really is
a
gem. And I don't think enough American citizens get the opportunity to go there and take advantage of all of the wonderful Smithsonian museums and all of the exhibits and all of the history that city bears for us. So I would really recommend it highly to anyone that, in Fort Mill just this week, we had the traveling Vietnam War Memorial. And I
we had that here in Greenwood. Yeah.
Yeah, it just was there. And obviously being in Washington, D.C., I got to walk in the mornings. I walked along the mall there. Mm-hmm. And I got to see the actual Vietnam Memorial, and it is, you know, very stirring.
Yeah, there is no comparison, though, to looking at the memorial up there in Washington, D.C., and to see the traveling one. It's great if you've never been able to see it.
Right.
But everybody should take that time to see that one. And, of course, they just opened the new Disabled Veterans Memorial up there in Washington, D.C., too.
Absolutely. I mean, it's one of those things that, in some ways, it's so subliminal, the idea, because you can't see the monument itself if you're just walking upon it. It's something that catches you by surprise. And
yes.
then as you walk along those walls and you see the names of all of those heroes who died defending what we believe in, it just takes your breath away. And you really have to sit and contemplate it for a while to understand just the depth and the breadth of that kind of heroism that is so hard to understand. And they deserve so much of our gratitude for everything that they did.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the things that was very special for me when I was up there was seeing all the items that are left at the wall.
Yeah.
Whether it was a magazine or a badge or a flower or whatever it was, there was something very significant being left. And I think it was also truly terrific that the Smithsonian they took those items and they kept them so that they could be put on display.
Absolutely. I mean, there's so many unique and meaningful things to see in D.C. And right, it's the Vietnam War Memorial is right down the mall from the World War II Memorial.
Yep.
And that, again, that's large and impressive, and it really does grab your attention. And certainly those heroes as well deserve our attention. But those are the things that that Americans, just everyday Americans, need to go and see and experience, because it's their city. It belongs to the public, right?
We kind of forget that every once in a while, don't we?
We do. We forget a lot that America belongs to us as the citizens, and that we have to not only take pride in what we have, but we have to take responsibility for it.
We should. We absolutely should. I'll tell you one more memorial story, and then we're going to leave this. The Korean Memorial there is very eerie, and when you see that one, you can really get the whole feel of what those men and women were going through over there.
Absolutely.
The gaunt look in the eyes and all of that. Okay, moving on. Now, we could spend a whole hour talking about Washington, D.C., and that's not the purpose here today. Mm. But one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know that much about is the American Party of South Carolina. This is a relatively new party.
Absolutely. It's a brand new party. We just got certified by the state of South Carolina in January of this year. Jim Rex, who was the former state superintendent of schools, mm-hmm. and Oscar Loveless, who ran for the Republican gubernatorial back in 2008, got together as a Democrat and a Republican and said, you know, the system is broken. There are problems that are mounting for our country, and the existing parties are not addressing those problems. They spend time fighting with one another. We've got to come up with something, another approach. And that's where the American Party, or the idea for the American Party, was born, in that idea that we need to focus on our economy. We need to focus on our global competitiveness. We need to focus on term limits and things that will move our country forward and not continue this hyper-partisanship, this bickering, this fighting that continues to go on in Washington, D.C., because it's destroying our country. So they were certified on January 23rd, and they really had a challenge that said, okay, by March 31st, basically, they had to see if they could find individuals who were willing to stand behind the party and go and run for office. And they were able to find four of us, myself included. I'm running for the U.S. Senate, as you said, against Tim Scott and Joyce Dickerson for the unexpired term, which is a 2-year term.
Correct.
To fulfill that which Jim DeMint had left. So this same office will be on the ballot again in 2016, so that people aren't confused. Senators usually serve for a 6-year term, and that is correct. But this last one was to fulfill the unexpired term of Jim DeMint, who left to go and head up the Heritage Foundation.
Is there just the American Party in South Carolina, or is this a national party?
It is currently just in South Carolina. South Carolina was the first state to go through the petition process and to get it on certified within the state according to the laws of the state of South Carolina. Jim is talking to a number of other people in other states who are very interested, but each state in the union has a different process for new parties being, if you will, certified and capable of being on the ballot. For Michigan, you have to get 30,000 signatures in a 90-day period of time. For Kentucky, it's something different. For Georgia,
sure.
It's something different.
Absolutely.
Yet again. So that's...
It has to do with the population and the size of the state.
Well, and the state's laws as it relates to new parties being validated, if you will, for
sure.
The ballot.
Sure. All right. So the issues, as you said, term limits... ethical behavior, focus on solving the nation's economic and competitiveness issues without the distraction of single issues and divisive politics.
Right.
That sounds wonderful.
Sure it does.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds wonderful, but how do you get there?
Well, you know, I think it sounds wonderful and it sounds reasonable and logical to most voters. And that's the important part, right, is that this is something that all of the voters are asking for. I was talking with the gentleman outside before coming in here, and we were talking about just the issues like this. The Democratic and the Republican parties have, in essence, left the people behind. They have gone on to be very focused on their issues, but not on the people that they serve. And so as we look at this as a nation, as a state, as a city even, we have to start to question, do those people that are currently serving in public office really have my individual best interest at heart, or are they more concerned about the people who give them money, the people who ensure that they get elected year over year, the people who are donating to their campaigns? Those are the kinds of questions we have to ask ourselves. That's why this looks so good to most people, because it is reasonable to expect that from our public servants.
But do you have donors?
I have very few donors.
Because you're a very new party.
A very new party, right. And
but yeah. You would have donors if this party... if this party takes hold, for lack of a better way to say it.
Well, I agree that a political process needs money to use the airwaves, if you will, television, radio, the media of all kinds, to get the word out, to get name recognition going. But I don't think it needs the extremes that we're dealing with and what we're seeing today. I was talking to somebody earlier. They're going to spend over $100 million, or they have spent over $100 million in North Carolina for the Hagan-Tillis race.
Right.
They're projected to spend over $100 million for the McConnell-Lundgren-Grimes race in Kentucky. Those numbers are obscene. When we think about what it means, what it's representing is our public servants who are really our employees. So one of the proposals that I'm going to make as if I am given the gift of becoming the U.S. Senator for the state of South Carolina would be that we restrict how much an individual candidate could raise and how much that individual candidate could spend. My current proposal is that we do it based upon registered voters, and it's $1 per registered voter. So in the state of South Carolina, that would limit the gubernatorial and the U.S. senators to about $2.5 million. Not an unreasonable sum, but at the same time, it's not an obscene sum either. It would limit the presidency to about $150 million, because there's about 150 million registered voters in the United States today. It's a way of giving a simple solution across the U.S. for every state, every city, every county, every role that is running by simply saying don't raise any more and don't spend any more than this. And it doesn't restrict who can give the money. It
right.
doesn't change those election laws, if you will. It simply limits the ceiling on both the raising of those monies and the spending of those monies.
Well, I have often thought, what would be if the dollars were limited? You know, millions of dollars would still give you a very big advantage. But if the dollars were limited, if you could only spend $50,000 on an election, would we see more of our legislators going door to door? Would they be out there talking to the people more?
Well, I think that certainly they would be talking to the people more. I think what the American citizens have forgotten is the power of their vote. I've talked to so many people, and they say, well, my vote doesn't matter, right? Or it doesn't matter. And if you look at the turnout that Americans have at the polls, right, we're anywhere from just above 50% to maybe 60% in a presidential election year. Most other countries, including countries like Afghanistan, who have just gotten the right, are well above 75%.
And they're proud to have their finger green or whatever, purple.
Absolutely. Yes. And that is something that we've lost here. And if the American voter would simply turn out to the polls in the numbers that they should be, they would start to learn that they do have. Their one vote is worth more than the hundreds of millions of dollars being pumped into the political system by wealthy donors today.
But that also, on the flip side, would mean that they should become schooled in the issues and what is happening, and we really need to put civics back in our schools so that our students growing up have some idea what all this political process is about.
Absolutely. And I have talked to so many young people, and one of the reasons why I got into this race in the first place was I have four grandchildren, and I looked at the state of our country and I said, what am I leaving to my posterity? What am I leaving to my children, to my grandchildren? And in the future, what will they look back and say about me in terms of what I did? And that was one of the key factors that made me decide to run, that at least I could look my grandchildren in the eye and say, I tried. Mm-hmm. I tried to do something to bring common sense and civility and responsibility back to the political process by running as someone who believes in this country very much and believes that we really do have the best in front of us if we are willing as Americans to roll up our sleeves and go to work the way that our parents and grandparents
did.
Well,
I think that's the biggest problem, because I think Americans don't have that will to roll up their sleeves and go to work.
Right.
I think we've become very passive. I think the handouts, having about 49% of our residents on food stamps and this type of thing, has taken a lot of that away from us.
Well, I think that it's taken a lot. There's a lot of things that have contributed to the fact that Americans are not getting out to vote the way that they used to. But one of the things that's really interesting as you really start to look at the data is this issue of, in the past, Americans made sure that the future was better, right? So mm-hmm. our parents or our grandparents worked hard to make sure that their children's future was better. We've started to back away from that.
And have we backed away from that, though, because of the economy and because of what we're dealing with, that we're not bouncing back the way, you know, a recession, a pullback? That's not a bad thing.
You know, my parents lived through, my father was born in 1915 and my mother was born in 1922. They lived through the Great Depression.
Right. But the economy came back.
Right, eventually.
And the wheels were put forth to make
right.
things happen.
Right, and that was the government that played a huge role in doing that. Anybody that's just watched the recent PBS series on the Roosevelts could see a lot of good history
sure.
and kind of understand what the government had to do in order to help bring America out of that depression. But there's a lot of things that we can do here today that don't require that. The Great Recession was definitely traumatic for our economy, but it did not bring us to our knees. And there are things that we can do to re-stimulate our economy, to bring good jobs back. The most important thing is we have to restore the middle class. The middle class is the linchpin in making America work.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got to...
How are we going to do that?
Well, one of the things that we need to do is we need to bring good jobs back here to the U.S.
How are we going to do that?
Well, there's an interesting thing called reshoring. So I'm a supply chain management geek, right?
Okay.
I'm a supply chain management executive.
Okay.
One of the big things that happened in the past was they did a lot of things about outsourcing and offshoring. So the American manufacturers moved jobs to Southeast Asia, to lower cost countries, because they were looking at the cost issues. But what they're starting to find out with the issues of risk, with the issues of global, the different issues in different countries with how those political issues are handled in different countries, the issues hurricanes or natural disasters, et cetera, companies are starting to realize that they cannot have a single location, whether it be in Japan or Southeast Asia or over in Europe, et cetera. They're starting to look at what their total cost of ownership is. And if we work very closely with those companies and we start to devise strategies and plans for them to bring jobs back here to America, and we align along much more of a geographic, if you will, hemispheric approach, so that we're looking at North and South America, where you can move things north and south by, not by boat or by air, but rather by wheels, by trucks, by train, et cetera. So those are the things that we can do. And there's actually a group out of Chicago called the Reshoring Initiative, and they're working very closely with a number of companies. And the numbers are coming back very positive. It will make more economic sense for companies to come back here. And quite honestly, companies want to work here. Americans are the most innovative, and we can create those innovative products and services, and that will bring good jobs back here. And as we begin to grow out of that, we'll be able to create other jobs in other areas, and perhaps even be able to solve our immigration problem by ensuring that there are jobs in South America that will keep the people there. They come here because they need jobs. Well, let's work on a more global scale and start to look at how do we do that. Ford Motor Company has done it very successfully. Ford Motor Company is the only company that did not take a government handout. But they are very successful in terms of what they do in terms of innovation in the U.S. and in terms of using lower-cost labor just over the border. So we can look at who does this and who's got best practices, and we can start to replicate that on a broader scale and bring good jobs back here.
There you go. And with that, I've got to interrupt you. Okay. You are listening to WCRS right here in Greenwood. Let's hear the news and a word from our sponsors, and we'll be back with Jill Bossi. She is with the American Party. She is running for Tim Scott's office. Hey, we'll be back afterwards. You got a question for Jill? You like what you hear? Give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here. We have a spirited conversation going on over here, a very spirited conversation with Jill Bossi. Fortunately, I guess she didn't have that name as a child, so she didn't. You know, there's a real thing against boss, you know, not using the word bossy with girls growing up these days.
Oh, I like being a bossy woman.
Well, what do you think about that? Just as this is off the subject.
Yeah.
But what do you think about the use of the word bossy?
Well, actually, that whole issue with Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In came up right around the time that I was starting to run, right? They were trying to ban the term bossy. And
right.
Certainly from my perspective, I like the name.
Yeah.
And I use it as a quip from time to time to make sure that people remember that my name is bossy and I am bossy, and therefore don't forget who I am. I think that it is problematic for young girls and women of all ages, as we grow up, there are so many things that society has done to pigeonhole us. And I think that the premise of the whole ban bossy idea was to stop using that word as a negative against young girls growing up, right? If a young boy is bossing people around, he's seen as having leadership skills.
Exactly. That's what
if a young girl is seen bossing people around, she's called bossy.
Right.
It's a definite dichotomy, and we can't do that. We need all of our kids to grow up to their full potential. And so we have to look at and figure out as parents and as grandparents, what are the words and the signals that we're giving to our kids as they're growing up, so that they grow up as being sure and confident and competent adults.
Yeah, I agree. So. I agree with you. Did you have a daughter?
I do. I have 4 children altogether. I have 2 sons and 2 daughters. Our youngest is in college right now. And they do live up to their name. They are bossy women. Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
All right. I just wanted to know here, to know that the bossy is still alive and well, I guess, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. Now, talking about Tim Scott, what is your feeling about Tim Scott?
Well, as we were talking about during the break, I've talked to a lot of people who have said to me, oh, I hope you're running against Lindsey Graham. And I said, no, I'm running against Tim Scott. Oh, I really like Tim. He's a nice guy. Well, that's great. And I've never met Mr. Scott, so I'm certainly not disparaging his character. But being a nice guy is not what it takes to be a U.S. senator. What is Tim Scott's performance? What is his voting record? What has he done? If you look at what legislation he's voted against, he's voted against the equal pay. He's voted against the Paycheck Performance Act. He's voted against infrastructure. He's voted against veterans. He's voted against the ban on sexual, or the legislation that was trying to get passed for fixing the sexual assault problems in the U.S. military. The only thing that he's voted for lately is for Citizens United, to maintain that stranglehold, that bad decision by the Supreme Court of the United States. What does that say about who he's going to be listening to when he goes to Washington? It doesn't tell me he's going to be listening to us as the voters, but rather to the people who are donating to his $6 million plus campaign.
Wow.
That's right.
Wow.
Yeah, $6 million. What does he need? I mean, I haven't raised near...
How much money do you have?
Very little. I have about $800 left in my Senate account. There you go.
I was going to ask you for some money to run on the radio station. I don't think I'm going to get it, folks.
Not from me or Joyce Dickerson, who is the other lady that's running.
I had Joyce on here the other day.
That's right. Both
she
of us.
She had $3,000 in her account.
There you go.
Right.
He had over $6 million, and he spent over $3 million on what? I mean, there's no negative ads running. Obviously, I can't afford to run TV or radio ads, so not sure what he's spending his money on.
Well, I know he's spending it on TV.
Yeah.
He is spending it on TV. I know he's not spending it on radio, or I haven't gotten any of it on the radio. Let's put it that way. So you're telling me that he's always out there working for our veterans.
Well, and that's another thing. You know, he does a lot of TV ads about supporting our veterans, and that's certainly a worthwhile endeavor, and I will talk a little bit more about that. But if you look at his performance on voting, he has voted against legislation that would protect our veterans. He has received a 0% performance rating from the Disabled Veterans of America, a 0% performance rating from the Vietnam Veterans of America. So somehow the vets themselves are saying he's not doing so good. And for me, that's a real concern. My husband is a vet. I have 3 of my 4 children who have served or are serving in the U.S. military. I have Air Force, Army, and an active duty U.S. Marine. So for me, the military is my family, both the active duty and veterans, and I want to make sure that they're being taken care of. I cannot stand it when I see the stories about homeless vets or vets who don't have jobs or vets that don't have food. In fact, on Friday, I'll be participating in a task force for homeless veterans in York County, where I hail from, because for me, that's a very important issue. And so I don't like it when people use issues like veterans as a political puff piece. Mm-hmm. And when they don't put their money, if you will, where their mouth is, and work toward getting and ensuring that the Veterans Administration and that whole debacle, and it's still going on even today, they can't fire the people who have mistreated our vets so abominably. That's ludicrous. In business, mm-hmm. if you had that kind of performance, it would be, bye, here's your papers, off you go.
Isn't that the difference between business and the bureaucracy? In business, you can lose your job. Okay, in the federal government, you can lose your job, but you're still going to get paid.
Well, and that's awful, right? And
it
shouldn't be in the bureaucracy. It shouldn't be in the public servants, right? Whether you're in Congress or whether you're serving in one of the administrations, whether it's the Veterans Administration or Health and Safety, et cetera. If you mismanage, if you do not perform according to what the requirements are, then you should be fired, period, End of discussion. No more.
That's what happens in corporate America, doesn't it, Jill?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
If you're not following what you're supposed to be doing. Now, everybody goes through a performance rating. Everybody goes through a performance review, right? If there are correctable issues, you work to correct those. But if it's something like purposely getting rid of data so that your numbers don't get bad.
Are we talking about lowest learner?
Yeah.
Yeah. The IRS, yes.
Tax reform.
Yes.
I mean, there's a great one. I believe in what I'm calling a fair flat tax, and I think we can completely and totally simplify our income tax process and program so that individuals and corporations know exactly what they're going to pay every year.
And maybe they could fill it out without having to have all these extra people to fill it
out. Let's reduce the size of the IRS. Let's simplify the tax code. I've talked to CPAs who have told me that the tax code has gotten so ridiculously complex that not even they can figure it out anymore.
Well, I think, and I think the other thing that happens is the policies can change during the tax year.
Right.
Which is ridiculous. If you started something the first of the year with knowing that you would get a deduction or whatever, halfway through the year, that can be gone.
Right. So let's simplify it. We have to maintain.
The thing is, they've never done it. They talk.
Right.
They talk. We talk here in South Carolina about fixing the tax code in South Carolina.
Well,
they talk about it as a garden hose that keeps getting fixed. You keep putting tape around it, but nobody ever does it. This is what I don't understand.
Well, and that's the intransience, if you will, of Congress today, right? Because those same people who keep getting elected over and over and over again and get sent back to D.C. over and over and over again, they don't think that they are vulnerable. So why should they do anything that would fix the problems when all they need to do is keep raising money and keep putting ads on television and have people go to the polls and keep electing them because they're going to vote for their party, not for the person? Why should they fix a problem? We have to ask ourselves as Americans.
Right.
That's what we need to start doing as American voters. We need to get out there and fire those people, right? We need to fire them all and start over again. It couldn't be any worse than it is today if we fired them all tomorrow, told them to go home and put a whole new 435 in the House and 100 in the Senate. It couldn't.
I agree with you. But one of the things that does worry me, Jill, is the fact that our government is so overblown and so big. It's almost like it's a bureaucracy that has a life of its own. And I question whether we can cut it back to something that is more simplified and does address the basic core things that we're supposed to be addressing.
I think that we can. I think that.
But what about all those people that have all those jobs up there? Mm-hmm. They would lose a lot of jobs.
Well, there is a balance. It's an interesting academic discussion, right, on how much does the federal government need to influx into the U.S. economy to ensure that it is a stabilizing influence on the economy versus how much private business needs to do and grow. I would venture to guess that most CEOs would say, let me flex my muscle and I can grow and help. And I think that we should be letting that. We should be supporting small businesses, and the federal government has a role to play, right? The Constitution is very clear on what those roles are. Let's allow the federal government to do that, but it doesn't need to be in everything. One of the things that I think I agree with Mr. Scott about is the Department of Education does not need to be in every state's backyard. Education is a state issue. It is a local issue, actually.
Correct, correct.
I'm from York County. Fort Mill School District is one of the best in the state. I'm very happy my children went through the Fort Mill School District. They got a wonderful education, right? But other school districts within the state of South Carolina are not so good.
Sure.
But we need to allow the states and the localities to deal with that, because if we think about it, schools, good schools, equals higher property values. Higher property values equals a better economy. It brings jobs. It allows employers to move in, et cetera. They're all interrelated, and that's what we tend to forget when we start to think about politics. We think it's a single issue. It's not. There are so many issues that are interrelated, and we've got to work to look at those relationships and build them all up together.
Absolutely. Well, we are here with Jill Bossie. She is with the American Party. It's a brand new party here in South Carolina. She will be on the ballot. She will be running against Tim Scott. Hey, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be back.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Ah, that's right. We're right back here. I'm Ann Eller. I am with Jill Bossy. She is running against Tim Scott. She has a lot of ideas. And I think a lot of what you're saying, though, Jill, comes from the fact of your business background.
That's true. I mean, I've been in business for 30 plus years. I've been in supply chain. Supply chain is one of those things that not everybody thinks about when they think about businesses. But my argument is no business can run without their supply chain. If the goods and services aren't flowing through that road, if you will, the company isn't working.
Right.
And so it's a very integral part of the overall process. And I believe in the free market system. Mm-hmm. I believe that the U.S. economy is still by far the most innovative and can be. It's not today, but it can be the strongest in the world. And that, quite honestly, the rest of the world looks to the U.S. in terms of the economic growth that we want to see.
But how do we get government out of the way, so to speak, so that these jobs and the innovation can happen?
Well, there's a lot of things that have to be done. And one of my experiences while working at the American Red Cross was to see just how intractable the federal regulatory system can be. The American Red Cross has had to suffer with the FDA for a number of years, and a lot of extra work mm-hmm. has come because of that regulatory environment.
Sure.
So, and you can use that in pharmaceuticals and in a lot of different places where there
That's
is a,
like the EPA, the
yeah,
FDA,
the FDA,
the FCC.
Right.
Yeah.
You can pick a lot of them. Now,
right.
We need some regulations, right? We want to know that our food sources are good. We
right.
want those labels. There's nothing wrong. I had a gentleman contact me the other day, and he was very concerned about GMOs. And he wanted to know what my thoughts were about it and whether or not I would support labeling. And I said, of course. It's not that much more for a manufacturer to add what GMOs are in their products
right.
on that
or
label
not,
or not
right?
than it is not to, right? So why not just do it? But at the same time, we don't want to overregulate business, right? It's a balance. We have to find what that right balance is to protect the public against, shall we say, robber barons, which do exist still today. But at the same time, we want to be able to allow the economy to grow. We want to be able to allow companies to expand.
Sure. Well, you know, you're talking about the return of the middle class. We need those middle class jobs.
Absolutely.
And if our economy was growing, those jobs would be there.
Absolutely. And that would lead to so many other solutions, right? If you've got good middle class jobs, well, those come with benefits. And those benefits include health care. And so if they're getting health care through their employers, then they're not needing to go through the ACA and get health care that way, which...
That's the Affordable Care
yeah,
Act. Yes,
right. And, you know, good idea, bad execution.
Right.
Good idea, bad development, right? It can be fixed. It can be much better than it is today. And I've had to experience it myself, leaving my job. I've been running this for this race for 7 months now, and that means that I left my health insurance behind, and I had to sign up for something. And I learned very quickly just how frustrating the website is.
Mm-hmm.
I learned very quickly how frustrating the offerings are to people who don't have insurance. And most people cannot afford COBRA, right, that's offered from
right.
your employers when you leave them. So there is a lot that we can do to improve that. But let's work together to improve it. Let's not be pointing fingers at one another and fighting over it. Rather, let's sit down around a table, get the experts in the room and the adults in the room, and let's get a solution worked out so that we can all move forward. But going back to the middle class jobs, let's get those jobs built, because once people have those and they have benefits, then they have extra income, and they're going to spend that on things that they want to have.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'm going to give you 2 minutes to tell all our listeners out there in WCRS land why you want to be the next senator and why you should be the next senator from the state of South Carolina.
Well, thanks, Ann. I appreciate it. So, number one, I believe that our elected officials are public servants. They are employees of the people of the United States, of the people of each of the states that they go to. So for me, that's a very important part. I have committed to term limits. That is very important to me. Two terms, that's it. I would not go any further. I am a big proponent of campaign finance reform. I think we need to change that system because it has become so corrupt. I want to see our economy fixed. I want to see good jobs brought back for the middle class because the middle class is the linchpin in the American economy. I want to make sure that our military is strong and secure, and I want to make sure that our vets are taken care of. There are so many other things that I would love to do, but I think that those are our priorities along with tax reform that we have to get working on first. And once we get that foundation built and we can start building up again, then America can take off again like a rocket. And we can not only help our own citizenry, but we can begin to take the world to kind of that next level where we need to go. And that means that we have to. And one of the things I wanted to say is, 3-5, deny a majority to either the Democrats or the Republicans in the Senate. The Senate is a body of 100 elected officials. By denying a majority to either the Republicans or the Democrats and putting 3-5 adults, dare we say, independents, into that room, you start to force the conversation in the Senate so that you have to talk about the legislation that is impactful for the U.S. You have to talk about getting things passed. You no longer have obstructionist government, but rather you have people who are forcing those conversations. So people like Greg Orman in Kansas or Larry Pressler in South Dakota. Those are the important things that we need to do, and that's what I could be, is another adult voice in that building. And that's what I want to do for the people of South Carolina, is make South Carolina famous because of the good politicians that we're sending to D.C., not some of the other politicians that we're a little infamous about.
All right. Well, Jill Bossie, thanks so much for coming out to talk to us this afternoon. I appreciate you sitting down with me.
Thank you so much, Ann. I appreciate the time.
Absolutely. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. That's going to do it for us. I feel like I've been interviewing all day. Well, you have, Ann. Bye-bye, everybody.